Founder Chats, the show where I, Josh Pickford, founder of Baremetrics, hop on a call with my founder pals and get the stories of how they started and grew their businesses. This week, I talk with AD Pinar, founder of WooCommerce and Conversio. We discuss growing up in Cape Town, how AD's entrepreneurial father and teacher mother influenced his career path, how entrepreneurship gave him a sense of belonging, and so much more. Enjoy. All right. Thanks for joining me, Addy.
Thanks for having me, Josh.
All right. So I would love to, I guess, to kind of kick things off here. I would love to kind of get your backstory, like you as a kid.
Wow, that you're saying
way back.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm not that old, but I mean, that is quite a while back. So I guess kind of simple things, dude. I mean, I think I had a wholesome kind of childhood, you know, very middle class suburbia. My dad was an entrepreneur since I can remember. He was working on his own stuff, somewhat related to computers and kind of finances back in the day, finding some kind of, you know, kind of hybrid of those things. My mom's a teacher. So kind of looking back at those things, I think I had two great worlds. For my dad's side, obviously the kind of the business stuff, but for my mom's side, with the kind of teaching background, I think I learned a lot about people and emotional intelligence. I kind of, that's parents, wholesome living. I have two younger sisters, which is interesting. So they were in the house, and I'm the eldest, and I think I was a terror to them. even though, you know, kind of today, I think I want to believe that they love me to bits. I think I had a very safe childhood to some extent, even though kind of looking back at it now, I never quite fit in anywhere until I would probably say university, where I probably rediscovered business and kind of this thing called entrepreneurship, which I think was the first time I really felt I had something in my life that was identity. I mean, I think that's kind of, you know, obviously skipping over a few, you know, couple of things. But yeah, that's childhood 80.
So you mentioned your dad was an entrepreneur. Like, do you feel like early on, did he involve you in that stuff? Or is it just sort of like, hey, I know dad does stuff like that?
No, so he definitely involved me. He involved me in two ways. The one was the part which was probably not so nice, which was, so since he was at the kind of intersection of kind of computers and finance or financing systems at that stage, he had me do a lot of data capturing for him on weekends, for which he didn't pay me. I mean, I got a McDonald's meal if I was happy for lunch, which, I mean, obviously as a kind of, you know, 10, 11-year-old, that was pretty cool. But the thing that he did do, though, that I will, you know, to this day remember is, even though the bulk of that kind of data capturing work was, you know, silly monkey work, right? Repetitive monkey work. Whenever I would capture something and I would ask him, like, you know, Dad, what is this? He would always take the time and he would explain this to me, you know, even if it was just this kind of, you know, simple invoice that I was capturing in the accounting software, and there was maybe something different. I mean, maybe the tax was different, or maybe there was multiple line items that was just out of the ordinary. And he would explain those things to me. And I think what he did via that was he at least kind of nurtured that curiosity I had about the almost the cogs that drive a business. So not just the kind of stuff that happens on the outside or stuff that you can see from the outside, but literally the cogs that kind of sit below that. So I definitely think he entertained those questions, and you know, he was always very kind of engaging, you know, when I had those questions.
Did you grow up in Cape Town?
I did, born and bred Cape Town, and I still live here, yes.
Gotcha. So, I mean, what was, obviously, or I assume as a kid, you didn't, you weren't like up on, hey, is there some sort of like entrepreneurial scene going on here? But I mean, now, is that something that you've seen grown there? Or is it like, I guess, pros and cons of growing up in Cape Town?
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess if you take the kind of tech and startup perspective, then that's changed a lot. So if you consider, I mean, I launched the very first kind of theme that became WooThemes 10 years ago this year. So if you consider the kind of, you know, the startup ecosystem in Cape Town back then, it was non-existent, or almost non-existent. And it's a very different space today. There's multiple kind of, I mean, Techstars has a like local iteration of their accelerator stuff running. So it's a very much a kind of growing or developing, you know, tech ecosystem and tech hub in that sense. But to an extent, I always feel like, you know, with it's interesting. This, obviously, I mean, I'm born free, right? Because I'm going to reference apartheid here. I'm born free in the sense that kind of apartheid mostly didn't affect me. So probably just before the classification of proper born frees. But the reality of that was, is my perspective about all races in South Africa is due to apartheid and the sanctions that the international community imposed on South Africa during apartheid, it actually meant that many people, for various reasons, had to find their own way in life, whether it meant kind of, you know, back in the day, you know, we weren't going to get kind of help from the international community. So sure. We have to figure out how to do things, which meant that, you know, a South African doctor in Cape Town was the first to do the first heart transplant. So there's always been that kind of entrepreneurial spirit. And even, you know, today where we have great kind of poverty in our country, I see, you know, many, many young, you know, entrepreneurs that have this hunger that unfortunately kind of the corporate and economic system in South Africa isn't conducive to everyone having jobs. So people have to find their ways, you know, other means of kind of making a living. So there's, I think, in terms of that, the core entrepreneurial spirit, I mean, it's definitely there. And my experience with it is at least that, you know, it's been there forever.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's a really great point that, you know, I mean, there's obviously a lot of depth that goes into the whole, like, hey, there's not enough jobs to go around. But at the same time, I think there's also something to be said of like, a people's, their ability to take something like that and say, well, I'll figure it out. And like, you know, I can't rely on the government to figure it out for me or provide anything for me. So like, I will do it myself.
Exactly. I mean, it's not kind of, you know, to talking well about something like apartheid, I mean, right, that is pure, you know, oppression, obviously. But I mean, like, we're beyond that now. It's something, I mean, it's a past event where nobody can go back and erase that. So, I agree with you. I think it's about resilience and, you know, taking what you have today and kind of figuring out a way forward, regardless of kind of the hand you've been dealt in the past.
Yep. So you, you mentioned university and it felt like that's kind of when you maybe sort of found your niche in entrepreneurship. So where you went to like full finished school there or just spent a little bit of time at university or?
No. So I spent 4 years at university. I did a bachelor's in accounting to become a chartered accountant and or auditor. And I absolutely hated every day thereof.
How did you pick accounting?
So our school system in high school, the two closest subjects that I could take that related to business was accounting and what we would call business economics. So it's not macroeconomics, it's more like business management is probably a better term to explain it. And I just really excelled at accounting and, you know, mostly... you know, maybe, well, obviously, I mean, I'm analytical, kind of logical by nature, but it got me close to business. I think that was an important thing. So I really love this. But going from like school accounting, which is accounting fundamentals, to university accounting, and then there's all kind of tax systems, and so, you know, it's just a bunch of stuff that, like, nobody really needs to know. Like, you can pay a consultant to help you with that kind of stuff.
Right.
At least it wasn't for me. I mean, I guess I went the completely opposite route in terms of kind of, you know, working on my own stuff, making my own stuff, and not being stuck in that, like, rigidity of, like, here's 10 rules and you have to apply them. And if this applies, whatever. That was just too rigid for me.
Yep. So what did WooThemes come about while you were in university?
Yeah, so in my final year of university, I needed to figure out a way of paying for my studies because my dad and I had a disagreement about what I was supposed to study in my kind of, you know, postgraduate year. And so I had to figure out a way to pay for my final year. And that kind of led me into doing consulting for WordPress initially. Mm-hmm. And by the end of that year, I built the very first theme that back then was called Premium News Theme, but that kind of, you know, sparked, you know, a lot of things that kind of allowed me to meet with my eventual co-founders, Magnus and Mark, and, you know, about 6-7 months later, we rebranded as WooThemes.
So at that point in time, what year was that?
That's November 2007.
2007. Wow, that's a long time ago. So, I mean, at that stage, I mean, WordPress had, you know, been around for, still, I mean, at that point, quite a while already. But I mean, what was the sort of theme landscape at that point? I guess more specifically, what was sort of the premium theme landscape at that point?
So it just got started. I mean, I guess if you trace it back and you ask anyone in the system, I mean, that first theme that I released alongside another another guy called Brian Gardner, and I think there was one other individual whose name I completely forgot now, but the three of us were kind of released the first kind of premium stuff at about the same time. So, I mean, premium themes, as you kind of, you know, as we know today, didn't really exist at that stage. There was a massive gap between kind of the free stuff that was out there that most people, right, myself included, kind of did as lead gen kind of stuff. Yep. And then the industry around kind of doing consulting for WordPress was flourishing. I mean, it just started flourishing already. But there wasn't that kind of go-between of, you know, selling, you know, products on top of WordPress.
Yeah, yeah. So how did you, I mean, that first theme, I mean, how did you even get that out there when there's not, that isn't sort of the standard, like, oh, of course I'll, you know, pay for a really nice WordPress theme.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is, you're probably touching on one of my biggest regrets, and not that I kind of, I don't think about life, you know, in terms of regrets too often. I mean, it's too harsh a word, but so back in the day, so the answer, simple answer is I launched it completely off of my own blog. And the kind of the context to that was my blog was getting about 30,000 uniques a day at that stage, which was purely, I mean, it wasn't my, you know, brilliant writing, because I wasn't, you know, even today I'm not a brilliant writer, but it was completely off of free themes. I mean, like free themes back then, I mean, the space was relatively small and WordPress started to blow up. So kind of, and I was a relatively early kind of mover in that space, which meant that if you put out quality free stuff, you would just get a hell of a lot of traffic. I mean, you know, kind of today, obviously, you know, my blog doesn't do close to that. And, you know, nobody knew about building the email list, except maybe, I mean, Noah Kagan probably knew that. I mean, that's, right, you know, that's his game, but, you know, nobody else kind of knew that back in 2007. So, but yeah, completely off my blog.
So at that point, I mean, was it even called Woo Themes? And what, that first theme?
No, when we, I mean, and the first theme was just called Premium News Theme, and it wasn't even like, the idea was never to have multiple themes either. I mean, but yes, yeah, so it was, the theme was called Premium News Theme. When Magnus and Mark joined shortly thereafter, we started doing a few other themes, and we rebranded slightly to Premium News Themes, using the kind of the plural there. Yeah. And then in July, I believe, the next year, we rebranded to something that was more kind of, that allowed us to grow, which was ultimately Woo Themes.
Gotcha. So, you know, I mean, are you, do you consider yourself a designer, or?
I'm a lover of beautiful things, Josh. Okay. So I mean, I guess I understand some design principles, and obviously back in the day, I dabbled, and I still regard myself as creative, but I mean, I lack the, just the technical ability to put what I have in mind, you know, onto a screen or any other form for that matter, or many other forms. So even though I did a lot of design back in the day, I was never a great designer, nor was I, you know, a great dev either. I just got, you know, both of those skills. I was able to do enough of them to get the business, to get the initial products out there and to grow the business. And, sure, you know, today I obviously, I do none of those. Right. You know, I focus on stuff that I'm actually good at.
So Woo Themes, I mean, you know, 2008, you guys, I guess at that point decide, hey, this should be a thing. And let's put a lot more effort into it. So is 2008, you start putting out additional themes?
Yeah. So I mean, by the time I think we rebranded to Woo Themes, we had already had, I think, 6-7 products. So okay, six, cool, seven different themes. And yeah, I mean, we definitely kind of had this hunch, that, you know, Woo Themes was going to continue growing. But I think, you know, it wasn't until about a year or so after that where Magnus and Mark, you know, actually came on board full time. So they kept their, you know, Magnus had a kind of full time gig, and Mark was still doing a lot of freelancing. I was the only full time person, you know, working on Woo Themes at the time. Because I think, you know, there's always this disbelief, right, where we're suddenly doing this thing which is seemingly pretty easy, you know, putting out work, we're just doing work and we're getting paid for it kind of thing. And we're doing nice work, you know, no real clients with deadlines shouting at us and that kind of thing. And it just kept growing initially. And I want to claim that we were this, you know, these great entrepreneurs that did these great things. But I think for at least for that first year or so, we literally were just riding the wave of kind of WordPress growth, you know, trying to figure out what this is, what we're actually working on.
So you guys are just keep kicking out themes for a few years. And then At some point, you guys start doing plugins as well.
Yeah, so this, I mean, and that came a lot later, and not because we necessarily kind of wanted to, but I mean, we had kind of a few, I think almost 18 months where we tried to work on, you know, a plugin on the kind of the precursor for WooCommerce, and nothing kind of panned out because we never had a very, very strong development and technical background. I mean, Magnus and Mark are, you know, much stronger designers, for example, than they were, you know, at least back-end devs. I mean, front-end development was, they were great at, but the kind of the stuff behind the scenes, you know, none of us were great at, and I don't think we had a culture of being great at those things, which meant that for about 18 months, we tried different avenues from kind of partnering to outsourcing to get WooCommerce up and running, and it wasn't until 2011, where we ultimately met, you know, two guys out of the UK, you know, Jay Koster and Mike Jolly, and they had been working on a separate WooCommerce, WooCommerce at the time, WordPress e-commerce plugin called JiroShop, and you know, we fell in love with the code, we fell in love with what they were doing, and we tried to buy the product unsuccessfully from the company that they were working for, which meant that our kind of plan B was just forking it. So we forked it, it was open source, and we made, you know, Jay and Mike offer to join us and lead the project on our side.
And so they did that, and you guys, I mean, is WooCommerce one of those things that sort of fundamentally changed the business?
Within about a year, WooCommerce made up 90% of our revenue.
So that's incredible.
It completely changed it. I mean, and you know, Josh, I mean, I think there are many entrepreneurs in this world who aren't humble enough in terms of how things change and how they never kind of plan for things. The reality is, kind of for us, was that we built WooCommerce initially because we wanted to build more themes.
Sure.
And what we ultimately stumbled on, and kind of the biggest part of that WooCommerce-related revenue, I mean, at least three quarters, you know, ended up being this add-on or, you know, extension ecosystem. And that wasn't something that we had planned when we started working on WooCommerce with Jay and Mike. I mean, that was a model that they had kind of created with JiroShop, this other company that they'd worked for, and we literally just adopted it. So we kind of fell into that. You know, so, I mean, we owe a great deal of, you know, our success just to, you know, I wouldn't necessarily call it luck, but at least our acceptance that maybe there was something else out there and we're going to give this a go. Not because this was our initial plan, but that was just the status quo at the time. And we, jumped into the deep end and, you know, kind of almost optimized from there on in, not knowing that there was even going to be something that we could optimize.
So you guys are doing WooCommerce, you got the theme stuff going, and then at some point you decide to leave. Correct?
Yeah, so that's about 2 years later from WooCommerce. So this was mid-2013, and I think I just got to a point where I wanted a new challenge. And the thing, interestingly enough, was the kind of the idea that I wanted to pursue at the time was a hosted version of WooCommerce. Because I really, I mean, apart for kind of, you know, finding a way where we were a proper platform that was hosted, where we had kind of a proper direct and, you know, persistent connection with the stores and the people that were using our software, which we obviously didn't have, you know, with WooCommerce itself. It was a downloadable, you know, product. You know, I really wanted to get into that. Plus, I just personally as an entrepreneur, you know, I just got to a point where this is kind of incremental now, and, you know, we've been profitable since forever, and this just wasn't challenging. And, you know, at that stage, I didn't feel, I mean, Magnus and Mark felt, you know, that they wanted to go a different direction with the business. And I felt that, you know, this was time to just kind of cut the cord and, you know, to try and recreate all of this. So I ultimately sold out. I mean, we started the process about mid-2013. And by the end of 2013, I had agreed a deal with Magnus and Mark to buy back my equity.
I mean, that seems, I don't know, 2 years is not a long time, but I mean, to leave something that you mentioned it was making up 90% of the revenue within a year of building WooCommerce. Like, was there any temptation to stay around only because it's like, holy moly, we've got a rocket ship here? Or, I mean, was it really just like, I'm a little bored?
Yeah. So a bit of both. And I think, I again, regret is such a harsh word, but you know, kind of my personal, if I look at my personal development and what I know about myself today and what I didn't recognize then, and I mean, it took me another 3 years from then to know this about me. But the way that I had mostly kind of built my whole identity as an entrepreneur was, you know, based on fight and flight mode. And which basically meant that I had, you know, or that related to kind of control issues and kind of always, you know, either thus fighting or flight, you know, kind of, you know, flying away, which meant that I was never going to be I feared being a passive person and a kind of passive, you know, a party and you know, in running this business. So that's ultimately why I felt the safer thing to do was to leave completely and properly, which, again, like kind of hindsight now, you know, maybe that wasn't necessary. Maybe there wasn't, you know, way for me to kind of, you know, exit in, you know, in a different way, not sell my equity, not sell all my equity, all of those things. But I was, you know, on the other hand, I mean, that's the one part of it. But on the other hand, I mean, I was definitely driven by this desire to have a new challenge. And also, I think, to kind of prove myself, which, again, I know now is partly kind of fight or flight mode, this idea of, you know, I have to prove myself constantly, mostly to myself. But I mean, that was definitely kind of, that was the headspace I was in. You know,
What do you feel like that comes from? I mean, the whole fight, flight, or freeze kind of things like is a natural sort of human response. But I mean, where do you think that comes from for you, for that being so strong at that point in time that you're like, I just have to cut all ties. I'm done and move on.
Yeah, so I mean, I wouldn't go too deep, but I mean, many experiences in my childhood got me to a point of, you know, whether it's not feeling worthy or not feeling good enough, or being told that there was, you know, that I could do better, meant that I don't think I ever had a good relationship with just being content. And,
sure.
You know, that kind of, you know, internal validation is something that I've only kind of probably in the last year I've learned in a wholesome way. I mean, I think I've always had internal validation to some extent. I mean, I don't think I would have been able to, you know, be involved in creating businesses if I hadn't had that internal validation. But that was also very much a kind of almost a, you know, F you world, I will show you kind of thing, which is more of a kind of, you know, fight response than just, you know, kind of this internal contentment about, you know, I'm doing this thing, I'm proud of myself, I'm happy with what I'm doing, yeah. You know, all those kinds of things. So, but yeah, I mean, it's definitely kind of childhood experiences. I mean, that's at least what my therapist tells me.
Sure, sure. So you've cut ties with WooThemes, and the next project you decide to start is Public Beta. Is that right?
Yeah, that's it.
So I remember Public Beta because of a specific product validation experiment that you did.
Yes.
So can you talk about that?
Yeah. So for anyone listening that didn't know what Public Beta was, the idea initially was, you know, some kind of entrepreneurial community of founders, and then we tried to do almost kind of to reference something else, you know, trying to do a treehouse for entrepreneurs. So, I mean, I had kind of through the years through WooThemes met many great entrepreneurs, and I kind of got loads of them to agree to do these short little kind of video courses, you know, on the site, and then you would kind of pay membership to be part of the community and get the content. So for the kind of the testing the idea and validating that there was something there, what I basically did was, after agreeing with all these entrepreneurs, and we had set up these courses, or at least the outlines thereof. But the challenge in that sense, I mean, to produce high quality video, obviously a very capital intensive thing. So we basically launched the website that promoted all, you know, this whole library of content, had a full blown kind of Stripe integration to do, you know, a credit card processing. And we got you to basically sign up, go through the whole process, did a pre-auth on your credit card to prove that you really wanted this thing. But then we never charged you. And at that stage, we basically told you, well, you've been added to your queue, because that was the kind of thing that was popular, you know, back then.
Yeah.
And we did that, I mean, obviously not having the content or the product. And we explained that to people, you know, in the kind of 2 weeks after we ran the experiment. But the kind of the goal with that was, and the goal that we achieved was, we really wanted to validate that people wanted to pay for this before we started kind of producing all the content. And if I remember correctly, I think we got to, we got beyond 1K in MRR, just running a kind of theoretical MRR, obviously, based off of that kind of experiment.
So I think, and the thing that I think probably rubbed people the wrong way was that they had put in their credit card info correct and then ultimately got nothing. Do you feel, I mean, in hindsight, obviously there's, you know, when you talk about a landing page, or a lot of times people will say, just drop your email address in, and then like they take the number of email addresses as being validation that somebody wants something, which isn't true. But then there's like the other extreme of it is like asking people for money is another side of it. And you like, you pick something sort of in between there, but like from a psychology perspective, there was a little bit of like, I don't, deception's a strong word here, but you acted like this stuff was there, and so that you could really test the idea, which I think is kind of fascinating. But what do you, at the end of the day, were many people upset about that, or kind of like, were they intrigued by it, or what was the overall response to this sort of like faux credit card charging?
Yeah, so I mean, I think as most things that happen online, you're going to find that some people were upset, and those that were upset were very vocal in that. Interestingly enough, I mean, so the people that actually added their credit card, I mean, I think we literally had one or two that were really upset. So whereas the people that were upset were mostly people looking, you know, from the outside in, to this thing, which kind of, I want to say it's fascinating. I think it's just actually very prevalent on the internet. For me, though, I guess the reality is I wouldn't do that again. Because I do agree, I mean, whilst deception is probably, again, like too strong a word, as you said, you know, there is dishonesty in that. And, you know, what I've learned since is, those kind of wins are relatively short term. I think at the time as well, it felt good. It felt like just, sure. I was hustling and I had proven this thing. But kind of, in hindsight, I look back at that and, again, regrets not too much, but I that just doesn't feel good. Like I look at it and it's like, well, it's not something that I would repeat. I mean, I didn't really learn anything about myself, or about life from that.
So you run the test. You mentioned what, $1,000 in MRR or theoretical MRR.
Yeah.
Ultimately, you didn't launch public beta. So was it? For you, did that was it because of that test didn't prove enough, or
no? We kind of hit a whole bunch of stumbling blocks beyond that. So what I never knew beforehand was that kind of getting someone to give me a theoretical yes and saying, "Hey, Eddie, I will produce this content with you," to actually kind of actually getting them to block off half a day of their time to do the create the content with us, was going to be a whole another ball game. So we got into a bit of that, and we tried to pivot out of that by kind of prioritizing the community aspect first. I think we had some great ideas in terms of literally. I think at one stage we were trying for the angle of kind of runkeeper for founders. So having a bit of not just community, so not just the discussion forum, but literally having some kind of accountability system built in. So I think there's a lot of interesting stuff there, and there's still a lot of stuff there that I'm very passionate about. But we ultimately kind of, we were chopping and changing stuff so quickly, it was just difficult, which meant that we never found traction on one thing. Within a couple of months before we ever kind of properly launched, I had just kind of reached burnout. I mean, the context or the kind of, subplot to all of this was, whilst we were going through this kind of 6 month, phase of working on this, that was also the exact 6 months that I had was negotiating my exit, which was a challenging exit from WooThemes. By the end of that, I was just, I was
done.
Screwed. I was done. I was like, this is it.
Yeah. So you decide to just shut it down on public beta. And then, I guess, at what point did you transition from public beta to starting what was originally called Receiptful?
Yeah, so there's probably about a 5-6 month gap there. I mean, and the intention was fully to take off a little bit more time. But, that stage, I only knew myself as ADD entrepreneur. So, I mean, there was like not working on something left this big void in my life, even yep. though there was always so many different things going on. I mean, I was a young father at the time, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's stuff that I could have done. But there was about 6 months, I stumbled onto an article that spoke about the missed marketing opportunities of email receipts, which then kind of sparked. So get the timeline correct. Public beta shut down at the end of 2013. And then I, like April, May the next year, 2014, stumbled onto this article and then start building Receiptful for initially the kind of idea was to build it on top of Stripe. And I mean, I have to say, Josh, I mean, you were at that stage, I think you had just passed 10K MRR on Baremetrics, and mm-hmm. you had taken the whole world by storm. I mean, none of us knew that the Stripe ecosystem ever existed. And, you know, that was a big part of the kind of initial impetus for what I'd hoped to do with Receiptful. And I think, you know, kind of almost in a very serendipitous way, you ended up being our very first beta tester for that MVP as well.
Yep, yep. So the Receiptful thing, I mean, I remember... I think it was that article you're talking about referenced Square a good bit, I feel like, or there was something with Jack Dorsey and like Square doing these like really interesting receipts. I could be way off there.
Yeah, no, totally. He was, so in that article, I mean, at the time, Jack Dorsey and Square was, I think it was still pre-IPO or maybe just post-IPO. And he definitely, what I can remember, I can't remember is the exact quote, but he spoke about kind of email receipts being a publishing medium in itself and how they were kind of doing interesting stuff with their receipts for Square merchants, at least. So we took a lot of, that article that I read, and took a lot of inspiration from that. And, you know, the kind of subsequent versions that we tried to build, we definitely referenced a lot about what, you know, Square were doing.
Yeah, yeah. So you initially, I remember you tried it on just on Stripe, but then ultimately you backed away from that. And was it a WooCommerce integration? Was that like the big play or...
Yeah, so basically what happened was with Stripe, it wasn't just the kind of payment processor underneath. The focus at that stage was also building receipt technology for other SaaS vendors. And what we found was that we could get engagement on receipts. So in terms of kind of, you know, open rates and click rates weren't bad for MVP products, but there was no kind of subsequent kind of follow through or real measurable benefit. Which I kind of realized that this was going to be hard. But we had all this kind of, you know, data, I mean, data reference points. So we could kind of point to, you know, the likes of Amazon and see that, you know, they've been including kind of product recommendations in their receipts forever. So if they're doing it, there must be a reason why they're doing it, right? So that's why we really pivoted from, you know, kind of focusing on SaaS vendors to e-commerce stores. And with my background in WooCommerce, I had hoped to leverage kind of, you know, WooCommerce as our first integration, our first platform. So a couple of months, we basically, based off of that MVP, we ran off Stripe, which I felt was enough validation. I basically took the plunge. I hired my first team members, three team members, and they started kind of almost, they ripped out a lot of the code, which, you know, today I'm very grateful for, but they ripped out a lot of the code from the MVP, and we rebuilt to a first version on top of WooCommerce, which we released, you know, publicly in November of that year.
Mm-hmm. So you decided to kind of move away from Stripe SaaS into e-commerce, really, which, I mean, in hindsight, makes a ton of sense given WooCommerce and the success that it had. But you had mentioned that the transition out of Woo, from WooTheme/WooCommerce was challenging. Was it challenging jumping back into that being... you know, having this at least tangential business relationship again?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, Magnus, Mark, and I, we probably only properly reconciled almost a year after Receiptful back in the day launched on top of WooCommerce. And a lot of that was 100% my fault. And, you know, and I had to kind of, you know, put out and that kind of olive branch again and say sorry for the way I had acted. But yes, I mean, it was a difficult situation. And I think even to this day, like anyone building anything for WooCommerce, if you don't get WooCommerce themselves behind you, it's very hard to find traction. They I wouldn't say they've monopolized it in a kind of malicious way, but the reality of the matter is, you know, kind of WooCommerce users trust them most. So if they're not distributing you, I think it's very hard finding alternative distribution channels, you know, for software or any product built on top of WooCommerce. So there was initial kind of, you know, that initial, you know, first year up until we kind of kissed and made up, it was hard.
Sure. So you're doing the email thing, email receipt stuff for a while. And then at some point you realize you need to do a little bit more, right?
Yeah. So that kind of, you know, sometime was actually 2 weeks after launch. So the initial idea was, you know, as a bootstrapper, kind of we launch a kind of, you know, whether it's a freemium product, but the idea is always to get to profitability as quickly as possible, which also means charging as quickly as possible. But we, with the kind of receipt stuff, we essentially saw within the first 2 weeks that the feedback loop for us to actually gather data and prove that this was going to be useful was going to be really hard, because we need to sign people up, they need to send receipts, we need to learn from that, we need to kind of improve the product, and then we need to kind of use that data and then improve product to kind of market and grow, et cetera, et cetera. But the reality was, in that first month, we sent 300 receipts in total. And that kind of feedback loop was always going to be too long for us to survive, right? So what we basically did was we made the whole product free, set kind of in that decision, realized as well, made a decision that we were going to have to build complementary tools eventually, sometime in the future, to monetize. So we were at least very clear about what we were going to do in terms of, you know, monetization. So it wasn't just a kind of hope and pray thing. But we definitely kind of, you know, made quite a shift there in terms of going free, and then not necessarily knowing when we will eventually have the kind of bandwidth or the time to start working on the paid stuff.
So I guess transitioning there. So you guys in November, I think it was, rebranded from Receiptful to Conversio.
Yes.
Right. So, I mean, you had mentioned as early as 2 weeks after you guys launched Receiptful that you realized we need more here than just simple email receipts. So how long was that sort of transition in the making?
So the timeline was essentially about 18 months since we launched the first non-receipts product to when we rebranded. And throughout those 18 months, we knew that our name was limiting, even though that, you know, we were starting to get really kind of, you know, good brand awareness and a good reputation around Receiptful. And kind of, you know, I think we were starting to build a good brand, and our customers and users definitely loved it. And we loved it. We got very sentimental about it, but we kept stumbling into these conversations where our customers would literally tell us like what you guys do other tools except for receipts. So we knew that this was always going to be very limiting. But at the time though, it just didn't, redesigns, rebrands are kind of a lot of work. And like the only thing you're actually getting is the thing you had before, which was, you know, a website and a logo, right? So it just didn't make sense for us. So we essentially delayed that decision, and we took on the pain of having a, you know, inefficient, you know, name that was confusing to some, you know, some of our customers, some of our prospects, for as long as we possibly could. And, you know, basically to the point where we were at least profitable, to then undertake this massive kind of redesign product, you know, project. And I think that our timing was relatively good in the sense that we also, alongside the kind of rebrand, we also released two, you know, additional core features, newsletters and product reviews, which, I mean, and that's kind of what we have today. We have 8 core features, which kind of makes up our first version of what we imagine an all-in-one marketing dashboard to be, which is kind of very closely related to us wanting to rebrand to Conversio in the first place.
Gotcha. So what's Conversio, is what, 15 plus people now, or?
We're 14 full-time.
Gotcha. And is everybody remote?
Everyone is completely remote. I love the fact that we don't have office overheads to pay.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So I'm curious, like, we've talked about lots of different things here, from design and development stuff and sales. Like what part of building a company do you feel like you naturally gravitate towards?
Ooh, I think two things. The starting part, I'm much better at the kind of the initial phases where, you know, kind of everything is, you know, it's a kind of blank canvas. Yeah. And I don't have to have much discipline in terms of being process driven and looking at data and all those things that I don't inherently or naturally enjoy. So definitely kind of the starting phases, I think I'm good at starting things. And then the second part, and the one that I actually have most passion for, is the team building aspect. I think I really enjoy working with people, and I enjoy leading the team, and I enjoy building the team in terms of, you know, whether that's adding more team members, or, you know, building kind of the processes, or kind of, you know, influencing the culture. Those are the things that I think are probably my kind of superhero skills, and, you know, in the sense, and that's definitely kind of the things that, you know, going into anything that we take on at this stage, any new project, those are the kind of things that I would kind of happily do, the things I would kind of naturally gravitate to.
It's really interesting talking to a lot of different founders here. So many seem to, I think, have realized that building a company is in large part just all psychology. I mean, right? Like, it's just people, and it's not code, it's not design. Like, those are byproducts, but like, you need to figure out how to work with other human beings, which is surprisingly hard, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I mean, I guess it is, you know, it is hard. And I mean, I mentioned, you asked me about my childhood, and I think, you know, I owe a great deal of, you know, gratitude, you know, to my mom in that sense, in terms of that kind of emotional intelligence. But I think, you know, beyond the hard part, the truth is always there. Like, you know, companies are kind of based on the people that, you know, work within it. And, you know, for me, it's always a, you know, you can find great talented people, you know, that are kind of, you know, stimulated by the thing that you want to work on, to work on those things with you. And you just need to figure out how, you know, that relationship makes sense for both of those, you know, parties. And yeah, I mean, that's definitely something that I think, you know, looking back at, you know, early WooThemes days to later WooThemes days and now at Convergio, I mean, that, I think that's the single skill that I've kind of almost gotten exponentially better at, I would think.
Yep. What's been a key part of the success for Convergio?
Oh, wow.
Or would you even say, I mean, I'm making an assumption there. I mean, do you feel like you guys have succeeded at this point?
Yes. I mean, I kind of, having spoken about contentment, you know, before, I would be an absolute hypocrite, but I didn't think, you know, that was the case. I think we've definitely succeeded. And I think, you know, as with any, you know, kind of company, there's multiple things that I think we've done well. I think, you know, one of the early things that we did really well was we built a product that surprisingly scaled for a very long time, kind of architecture-wise, infrastructure-wise, before we had to kind of start making incremental improvements there. I think that saved our bacon in the early days. We took a little longer to launch to get stuff ready, even though I was impatient. You know, my product team just told me, AD, you're going to be grateful. So I think that's kind of in the very early weeks, that was something we did well. And then a lot of our initial traction came from just our customer support, which was something I learned at kind of WooThemes. I mean, at one stage, almost 40% of our just product reviews or app reviews on the Shopify App Store, for example, specifically mentioned a great customer experience, support experience. And, you know, that's something that, you know, that we're very passionate about. I know many companies say they're customer centric or whatever they want to call it. But that's definitely something, like, relationships are important for us. And we really try our hardest, you know, to kind of let that shine through in, you know, everything we do. So, I mean, that's definitely two things from the top of my head, that I think we, you know, we've mostly figured out at least two of our strengths. I mean, we have many, I mean, I'm not going to pretend to have figured out our marketing or sales or any one of those, you know, kinds of things yet. I mean, those things, there are many things we still need to learn, but I think those things we do relatively well, regularly at least.
Was there any singular inflection point, sort of like WooCommerce was for WooThemes, where growth, there was like a big inflection point where the growth changed, increased, picked up? I mean, have you guys had anything like that?
Well, I'm going to say yes, and I think I'm going to tell you something surprising. So, I mean, our growth has been relatively linear since we started charging, with kind of periods of where it probably accelerated a little. But since, so, I mean, our pricing is tied to average order volume of our stores, which basically means business performance. So kind of we up and downgrade people, so expansion MRR, contraction MRR, based on how many orders they process, which is not something that Convergio itself influences, or at least not exclusively influences, right? Which meant up until kind of, you know, peak retail, you know, end of December last year, we experienced very, very nice growth. And then we literally got back to the highs of the end of December a month ago. So we've, you know, essentially been at the same point for, so we went down a little and we've come back up, you know, about a month ago, which has been an interesting experience. I mean, that's very kind of, you know, counter to what we're told, you know, kind of SaaS or recurring revenue companies, you know, should be doing. So, you know, we haven't had that real inflection point kind of hockey stick growth, but we've definitely experienced a different kind of phenomenon in terms of, you know, what our MRR chart looks like.
That's, I had never, I mean, that makes total sense, but you've got this like e-commerce SaaS thing going on where you're like, you're subject to the whims of seasonal sales on some level. That's super interesting.
Yeah.
So I don't know, as a follow-up to that, I mean, what's been the hardest thing about building Conversio?
Patience. Yeah. I mean, that's probably the one thing, Achilles heel in my life that, you know, I'm yet to learn, to be more accepting of, like, you know, some things just take time. And I think, you know, I want to blame the universe, at least to some extent. I mean, I think, you know, if we just take in our little kind of, you know, micro piece of the world in terms of the tech ecosystem, I mean, we're not, and I know you've written about this, you know, a ton, especially in the last year as well, but we're not taught to have a very kind of healthy or wholesome approach to growth and success in terms of, you know, tech ecosystem. And I'm not even talking about looking at unicorns and thinking we should all be kind of, you know, $1 billion companies that, you know, IPO. But even for smaller companies, like, you know, all of the reference points, all of the best practices out there, you know, they're very singular and they say one thing. And what most of us have learned over the years is that one thing unfortunately doesn't apply, but we still look at those things, you know, and like, I feel about it. Like, I still, you know, to this day, you know, Nathan Barry, ConvertKit, you know, a friend of mine, I still look at, you know, kind of where his business took off completely, and I'm like, why is this not happening to me, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's obviously such a kind of, that's such a bad way to look at the world, right? I mean, if we're constantly comparing, you know, it's very hard to be content and very hard to feel, you know, successful. But, yeah, I mean, that's definitely the hardest part. And I mean, and most of those things, I think, and that coming back to my initial, you know, answer of, you know, patience and just, you know, taking time, I think most of those things probably end up evening out, or you get a more true version of, you know, kind of the story when you kind of can, you know, extrapolate that horizon, right? Where it's not just looking at this month and not just thinking about where we need to go to next month, but as you should start thinking about a year and 5 years and 10 years, then those things probably even out.
It's so true. I mean, I find myself, especially we've been in this like run up to $1 million run rate. And I find myself sort of obsessing over our own Baremetrics dashboard. But also the inverse of that is when I don't get obsessive about it, like say I take a week off or something and I don't check it, you know, obviously I come back and it's not like growth stagnated while I was gone. Like it keeps doing its thing. And it's a much healthier look, way to look at things, to not just sit there and like obsess over the numbers every hour or even every day. Right. And yeah. I think that's a really hard thing to be able to get past.
Yeah. So my team now, like whenever, like they know when I'm getting anxious and impatient about things. And like, they will just tell me like, AD, just stop looking at the metrics, just stop looking.
Right.
So, cause there's, you know, again, like, I mean, you know, why, like, I still want to know, like, who made the rule that kind of every recurring business, you know, a revenue business needs to grow month on month and that growth needs to kind of accelerate. And, you know, linear growth isn't allowed. We have to kind of, you know, we have to grow the growth, which is, you know, by all means, like, that's great, like, if you can achieve it, but, you know, that shouldn't be the default. Like, that shouldn't be the starting point for kind of, you know, measuring these kinds of things.
I think a lot of people, especially new entrepreneurs who haven't like really ever built a business, don't realize like things like, you know, even 5% month over month growth is so atypical in the rest of business, right? Like if it's like other people, any other business in any other industry, it's like we grew 5% in a year and everybody's stoked, you know? And like just something with the tech startup scene, there's this obsession over just the weirdest amounts of growth.
Exactly.
And it's a hard part to get past.
Exactly. I mean, like, and you would think, like, I mean, remember for like Blue Themes days, I mean, we had once-off sales, right? I mean, there was very little. Recurring revenue made up 5% of revenue. So, I mean, some months we were up significantly, and then for the next 2 months we were down, and we didn't know why. And I would think, even thinking about that now, that should have been have had this kind of normalizing effect, effect on my own expectations. But as soon as I got into kind of pure recurring revenue business, I also started thinking we have to hit 5 or 10% in a month, right. Month over month, every single month. If we can't do that, it's a shitty month, and I'm not going to feel good about it.
Yep. Well, I mean, the crazy part is you can't even do, keeping 5% or 8% or 10% or whatever, the math doesn't work out on that long term, but it's in your head, you still sort of extrapolate it and you think, we've got 10% this month. Well, if we do that for the next 12 months, we'll be a $50 million company, right? But no one ever does that. But we still think of well, what if, and the what if part is really hard to get past a lot of times.
Yeah, I would want to offer anyone some pearls of wisdom about how to get past that, but I'm not past it, dude.
No, I'm not past it either. So, was there a time that you thought that Conversio might not make it?
No, I don't think so. I hope that doesn't come across as being kind of overly pompous almost. Or arrogant, but no. I funded about the first 6 months, of the business, and then we raised a small, small seed round, about $500,000, and based off of that seed round, we were able to get, to profitability, or kind of, yes, we did get to profitability, because obviously by that stage we had some revenue, so we basically cut our, in the last couple of months, we were very close to kind of being break even. And, ever since then, to this day, we still run very close to break even, where, I basically made the decision to invest as much of our the profits as soon as they're there. As soon as the gap opens, we reinvest it into the team or, whatever. But no, I don't think I was ever scared that this was going to die. I probably also felt that, there's always ways to kind of, cut back on things, whether it is, asking, I think that's what you guys did, right? When you asked some of the team members to take, or I think all of you took, some kind of, salary break or salary cut for, for some time, just to kind of preserve runway. So I always felt that, we had a good product and we had good customers and things were growing. So I always felt that we'd have enough time to make those small incremental changes to at least get us to break even. Because I think that kind of bootstrapping, at least, or self-funded kind of profitable mindset was always kind of at the forefront of all our discussions and decisions, which meant that I knew I wanted to get as close as it as possible, because as soon as you're close to it, you can probably make a few quick, small changes to then get yourself there, which then gives you that infinite, timeline to figure things out and, create a basis and then kind of grow from there.
What's the next year look like for you guys?
I think mostly two things for us. So because we went very wide on the product initially, so we built all these, we have 8 core features, as I mentioned earlier. So right now on most of those features, we don't have feature parity or even close to it to kind of individual, companies that does just that. So if you take a very simple example, our email newsletters are not as advanced as MailChimp, right? So we have kind of some maturing to do on those individual features to get to, not necessarily feature parity, but to eradicate the biggest or most prevalent objections we get from prospects and customers, about those things. So that's kind of on the one side. And then on the other side, this thing that I'm very, very excited about that I won't share too much about, but we're launching a nonprofit soon that's basically going to do work to promote and encourage and research, because there isn't much written about this, but sustainability in e-commerce and just, sustainability in retail, because we definitely have a passion for things that's not consumerism, for example. Sure. So we're going to try and launch that and, get that off the ground, in the latter stages of this year as well. So those will be the kind of two predominant, things we're working on. And then we still need to, we have a couple of you know, primary, you know, marketing channels working for us, for example. But we need to kind of beef that up, you know, beef that up and diversify from there and not be as reliant on those. So there's still kind of work there. And obviously those things excite me less. I'm not process driven, as I mentioned. Sure. So yeah, I mean, the kind of the product maturation and the nonprofits are things that I'm very excited about for next year.
That sounds great. That sounds great. Well, Eddie, that's all I got, man. Yeah, unless you got anything else you want to add.
Dude, I mean, I like to be respectful of your, you know, the time you try to hold your, you know, episodes to, I will not say a further thing. I suspect we can continue riffing for hours.
Yes, indeed, indeed. Well, cool, man. Well, thanks so much for hopping on a call, and it's been great chatting.
Likewise. Thanks for having me, Josh.
All right. Eddie Pinar with WooCommerce and Conversio. Thanks for listening this week. If you need revenue analytics and insights, check out baremetrics.com. If you have any feedback, I'd love to hear it. Shoot me an email, josh@baremetrics.com or on Twitter @Spigvard. And then head to founderchats.com to listen to a bunch of other startup chat conversations. Founders, conversations with founders. What is this thing? Who even knows? If you enjoyed this, a rating on iTunes goes a long way. And that's all I got. Thanks for listening.